Hi, and welcome to the Transform Your Wellness podcast. I am Karen Hugberg, and I'm a health, wellness, and life coach who help people transform their wellness and life and help them create more balance, ultimate wellness, and a life they love. The Transform Your Wellness podcast is heartfelt conversations with incredible people who are contributing and following their passion and soul purpose. It's conversations with people who have not only transformed their own life, but also contribute to the world by helping others, others transform as well. So today I have the absolute privilege to have a heartfelt conversation with George Courtos. You must correct me if it's not right.
No, it's fine.
Who I met on the beach at Southwest Rocks, and it is a town located on the north coast of New South Wales in Australia. And George asked me if he could take some photos of me on the beach, and we started chatting. And I really felt that George was a beautiful, awake, and aware soul with lots of life experience and love for life. Mm-hmm. And George was born in Sydney of Greek parents, grew up as an active youth, and was interested in activities in and on the water. And that inclination has been with him his whole life. He's been a rower, a sailor, and continue his passion for ocean swimming. He has worked for 30 years in the federal public service, is educated in marine science, and has a passion for photography, of course. He gets great pleasure from sharing his knowledge and experience, and have spent much time giving talks, presentations, and field tutorials, but his family is his flame. He's has a fascination with the natural world, and find no day goes by without learning something new and amazing. So this podcast title is The Key to a Balanced Life. So welcome again, George. I'd like to start asking you about your childhood. Where did you grow up, and what was some of your highlights of your childhood?
Well, look, I was born in Sydney of Greek parents, and when I was born, my father was away in New Guinea in the war, the Second World War. So I grew up in those war years, with my dad only intermittently visiting, but my mum was living between my dad's family and her own family. She was moving from one family to the other while dad was away. So I suppose from the very beginning, that sense of family, and in, as you know, with the Greeks, the extended family is an important part. And I don't think that ever leaves you, because those family connections have remained until today, and my children and grandchildren have seen that as an example. So, you know, the bottom line is it's about us caring for each other, and they see that not just that in that atomic sense, but in the broader sense. Mm. And we need to look back to how less developed cultures maintain that, and we look at the strife and the hardship, whether it's war or famine, and we see those things at work on our TV screens, and they're integral to those people hanging on. And you think, my God, how do these people do it? But they do it because of that sense of connection. And modern life in Sydney or the Gold Coast, it's very easy to lose that. But being Greek, I think there's that. The Greeks, the Mediterraneans, maintain that very strong sense. And, yeah, that stayed with me all my life. So that's the beginning. And I'm privileged in having a large family on my mum's side and my dad's side. But I also had the good fortune to have a good education. My mum and dad were steady people. Education was valued. I went to good schools. as I became a teenager, I became lazy and distracted. And I have some regrets that by the time I got to late senior high school, my head was everywhere but in the books. But it's amazing what sticks. And I was a late maturer. Can't have regrets about that. That's just the way you are. But the minute I found a girl who I felt was going to share my life, I started to get very serious about self-improvement, doing something with my life. I had a job in the public service and I started to study and work hard. When you go into a marriage and with the intention of having children and what have you, that was a driver for me. You know, we want to have a family and that means being able to afford a house, and you do that best by, you know, self-improvement, getting better paid jobs, promotion and so on. So that became a driver. And all of that happened. But the driving thing can get a bit out of hand, Karen. And I suppose there was some obsessionality there, which I didn't recognise until later. But that wasn't there as the carefree, rather lazy and distracted young boy at school. That started to manifest later. So that's the background. I had a very satisfying career. I was involved in a lot of change, some serious policy initiatives, things like that. But at the end, one thing started to disappear. And that gets to the heart of the sort of things we're talking about, and that's balance. Work becomes more consuming. And you reach a point where you're in the office late at night and you realise your kids are in bed. You weren't there at breakfast time, dinner time, and the kids are in bed.
Yeah.
And that might be the case until Saturday morning. So that awareness that you're losing balance, if you have a background like mine especially, it starts to weigh heavily. And in the end, you've got competing things happening in your head.
And no doubt, I mean, it sounds like your family's probably the highest on your values, or one of the highest values you got. So that would have been a bit hard for you to, you know, put so much time into to work and miss out on what was truly, really, as we said before, that's your flame. The family is your flame. So you can only do one thing so long, so hard.
Yes.
But after a while, it sort of takes its toll, doesn't it?
Well, it does. And I think there's a little bit of distraction. People talk now in this modern era, this enlightened era, people talk about a work-life balance. And at first that resonates, but there's a danger in that saying, in that it means that work isn't life. Somehow life is something else other than work. And I think that's a distraction from some realities. Work is life, whether we're out ploughing the fields or whether we're giving policy advice to government or whatever we do, or if we're looking, or if we're looking at a beautiful cuttlefish under the sea as part of your work. Work is life. And I think we need to be careful with this modern interpretation of separating work and life. We use this term work-life balance. And I think a lot of people find wonderful fulfillment and are able to balance that fulfillment with other things, including family. So work-life balance, it's only when things get out of balance that it becomes destructive. So if this, you know, you're seeking pleasure at the expense of of doing something worthwhile with your work, then that's also out of balance, you know. So in the end, it got out of balance with me. The career was everything, and those decades of formative family values start to prick away at the back of your mind, and there's a conscience: I am missing out. The kids are missing out.
Yeah.
What is really important? And in the end, a health problem develops, and a reassessment is forced on you. A reassessment.
Yeah.
You know what is of high value, and you know.
Yeah.
In the end, that you know that just has to come out and come forward again. That happened to me.
Yeah. So what happened then? Tell me a little bit about that period when you hit, obviously something really hit you, or you had some ill health, did you?
Yes, and some of it wasn't immediately identified as stress related. You know, you're in the cardiac ward in the middle of the night, and all the tests the next day don't reveal a life-threatening heart condition. But then when people start to talk to you about your life, then, you know, slowly the pieces fall into place. So you take a step back, and it's time for change. And at the time, I took a bit of time off. But it's amazing. At the time that happened, I'd formed a relationship with a professor at a university. And he was involved in the earth sciences. He started professional life as a geologist, and then he got into marine geology and then microbiology in the oceans. And he became my mentor.
Okay.
And I was appointed as a citizen member of an advisory body, but over time, my heart had always been with the ocean. And I had a view of the natural world that was beyond just the trees and the bugs. I started to focus on how we fitted into the natural. We're organisms. I mean, we have an arrogance about who and what we are in the scheme of things, but the reality is that we're part of the natural world. So all of that. So the good professor who died not all that long before my mum, and it's left a huge hole.
Yeah.
But he was my mentor. So I started to become educated by him and at the university.
Yeah.
And educating myself. And before too long, we're doing meaningful work. And the passion for that, and of course that needs photography. So the passion for that and my love of photography and the beauty of things.
Yeah.
Just also I found a new life, and it's just been the most wonderful, wonderful thing.
So, George, how old were you when you had that transition, or that, you know, the ill health and then the transition?
Yeah, mid-40s.
Mid-40s.
And it was, you know, it was serious. And it was serious for the family because, there was this uncertainty about, not uncertainty about me going or dying or anything like that, but, you know, uncertainty about what the future was. And my mum, a day at a time.
Yeah.
A day at a time. And I had the good fortune during that time of personal reappraisal, I had the help of a man who was helping Vietnam veterans. He was giving counsel to seriously traumatized Vietnam veterans. And we know the damage that happened to a lot of those people. It wasn't just the stress of am I going to die and all of that sort of thing. That in itself is bad enough. But a lot of them were traumatized because they didn't believe in the cause. There were a lot of people who came back from Vietnam knowing that the cause wasn't just, and that ate away a lot of people also. So he had this experience with all of these traumatized people. Fear or moral doubt or whatever. And he came into my life, and we spent a lot of time walking the beach, reconnecting with the sky, the fresh air, the ocean. While he helped me refine a lot of life's values.
So that was probably
the starting point, those conversations that I had with that man. And they took place over some time. But he knew me well enough for those conversations to happen outside, as I say, at the sea, on the beach, among the trees or whatever. So there's also serendipity involved here.
Yeah. I was going to say first, though, I mean, how important was it for you to have that mentor coming into your life?
I would say it was critical. It was critical. I'd already volunteered to be involved as a citizen on an advisory body, but this man was a man of great passion. And in that, he was a big picture scientist. One of the limiting things with some science is that we admire specialty where that ever sharpening focus, but we need people who take a step back from that and appreciate the interrelationships, the bigger picture. And my colleague, my mentor, was one of those people. So having started as a geologist and then got into marine geology and then started to look at the organisms and whatever, he was starting to take that step back from the fine detail, which is critical. I'm not saying that's short. But the interrelationships are also critical. And that's the way I work now, and it's what I look for in the work that I do, the interrelationships. Yeah. And once you do that, you start to see, for me, I start to see our place in the order of things, our place as people, as human beings, as organisms. Start to identify our place in the order of things. There's a man called Hugh White. And he writes about what constitutes a good life, things like that.
And
these things, you know, when I became involved with my mentor, he's a well-recognized scientist, and the thought of making a fortune from science couldn't have been further from his mind. It was the honesty of science, the exploration of science, and where that takes us for a better world. Making money is one thing, but I read things about what constitutes a good life. And it's about giving that thing that improves things, whether it's another person's life or improves what our grandchildren are going to inherit. And that's a big driver for me now. Not just my grandchildren, grandchildren, everybody. And they're the things now. And there's a intrinsic connection with family and all of that. I want to leave my legacy to my children is that I've worked for a better world. Those things, is that a good life? Well, for me, that's more important than looking important in my Porsche. Whatever, you see.
So let's look at what we've been talking about so far. just looking at the keys to a balanced life. So if you want to, you've had some golden nuggets here so far, but if we want to sum it up, just what we've spoken about in the last 20 minutes, what would you say some of the keys would be so far?
Correction, it wasn't Hugh White. He's a diplomatic expert. It was Hugh Mackay, who's a sociologist. Yeah. Hugh Mackay's writings. Now, look, we met at sunrise on the beach.
Yes.
And it was a beautiful sunrise, as they all are, but in this particular morning it was balmy.
Yeah.
You were down to your swimming gear or very light gear, and you're enjoying a moment that it caught my eye. You're enjoying the moment, the new day, the colour of the dawn, and that caught my eye and it resonated with me. And we had a little conversation not all that long after that. I was with my wife.
Yeah.
And you asked me about my age and what have you, and I spoke about a number of keys in life for somebody my age. And as you age, little things become more important, like your mobility.
Yeah.
My mentor rang me one morning and said, "George, I need your help. What's the matter? I've got out of bed and I've tripped and I can't get up off the floor."
Yeah.
And alarm bells rang in my head. My goodness, I don't want that to happen to me. So do I need just to be lifting weights and swimming?
Yeah.
I need to be doing things that, so there were five things, I think, or thereabouts, that I spoke to you about. One of them is diet. Balance in diet, a healthy, balanced diet.
Yeah.
Does that mean we should be punished? I remember in my mum's nursing home, one of the family members spoke in outrage that when the people in the dining room asked for a second serving of dessert, she said, "No, they should. You know, we've got to be careful of their diet." And these are people in their 80s and 90s. Come on. We're not punishing people. But we come back to that word balance. So I believe that a balanced diet is critical to leading not only a good, healthy life, but the older we get, the more important that becomes. So, yes, a glass of red wine at night, but not half a bottle or a bottle at night, you see? Plenty of fresh vegetables, nutritious food, but hey, dinner with the family on Sunday night, of course there's going to be rich Greek desserts and what have you. The second thing that's critical in our lives as we're herd animals, we're tribal, we're all of these things, and we need social intercourse.
Yeah.
We need that sense of connection. We need that sense of belonging. Now, family satisfies that. But in my view, it's healthy to also be connected outside of that. It's an old saying that's bashed around a lot and that came to the fore with COVID: it takes a village to raise its child. And that only happens through connection. You can't have a village raising a child, and I believe in that saying. That's all about that connection beyond the family, beyond that atomic family, mum, dad, and the two kids. And the older we get, the more important I believe it is to maintain that connection. So join. I belong to the Historical Society. I give talks. I belong to a swimming group. That's not everybody's cup of tea, but I think doing something that maintains that link out there with the community or society. Yeah. So the importance of social intercourse, meeting people, having an exchange of ideas, it's all part of maintaining your mental agility as well as that feeling of worth that you belong to something.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's number two.
Yeah.
Number three, Karen. Yeah. Why was I on the beach that morning? Well, that was my morning walk. And I believe exercise, for whatever purpose, is critical to our lives from birth to death. But the older you get, I think the more important exercise becomes, but in a different way. Flexibility, maintaining weight bearing so that your bones retain calcium density.
Yeah.
So flexibility, being able to tie up your shoelaces, a thing that people your age take for granted. And that's why things like gardening, when I was rowing and what have you, gardening is exercise.
Yeah.
But at my age now, it's almost yoga in nature. You're reaching, you're bending, you're lifting. So all of those things are exercise.
Yeah.
Tailored to your age needs.
We don't want injury. Yeah. It's true, isn't it? You really got to be accepting through the changes in life as we grow older. That's something that I've learned too through injuries, just accepting where you are and you know, but keep moving and not stopping.
Yes, yes. Yeah. Look, what you're talking about there is an important thing in our psychology as we age, and that's being able to move the goalposts. I'm 80 next birthday, not 18. As much as sometimes I feel 18 inside, the reality is if I try to be 18, I'm going to hurt myself and it takes a long time to recover. So, so tailored exercise, moving the goalposts, but maintaining that daily routine of whatever it is, walking, swimming, yoga, Pilates, any of these things that maintain. And look, you should never undersell the psychological importance of exercise. Getting out and walking on the beach at sunrise, how good.
Yeah.
Taking a bush walk, being with the trees and the ferns and the birds.
Yeah.
Beautiful. So exercise. Intellectual stimulation. Don't ever give up. That's, again, George. Don't ever give up on each day offering something new. You've learned something. So you might formalise that by, as you age, learning a language.
Yeah.
Taking up a course. University of the Third Age. There are all these things that help you to maintain intellectual stimulation. You can get that from a group that you join.
Yeah. So, no doubt you've kept that going. Your learning and stimulation of the mental. I definitely picked that up as soon as I met you. I was going to say, do you talk Greek?
Look, yes, in a very, I call it survival Greek. It is survival. I mean, I can live, get away independently when we travel in Greece. I couldn't speak English when I started school because that's what was spoken in the home.
Yeah.
And my parents, well-meaning but ultimately misguided, to help me and my siblings assimilate, stopped speaking Greek in the home. Now, it's only a matter of time before there's a price to pay. And as I say, that was well-intentioned but misguided. And I would say to any immigrant family now, whatever you do, maintain your mother tongue. Whatever you do, have your children maintain their mother tongue. It's not going to hurt their education in Australia or their English, but whatever you do, do that, because that's your cultural connection.
That's good to hear. You know, George, that I'm Swedish, and I brought up my kids. I spoke Swedish at home. So they got a good base and they still understand them. Actually, my son at the moment has just arrived in Stockholm to visit family. But that's been a real gift and I absolutely agree with you. That's important to do. And I think also As I get a bit older, it's more important to have that connection too, because that ultimately is, so I lived half my life, or half my life I've lived in Australia now, but half my life I lived in Sweden.
Yes.
And they were the obviously the crucial years of, you know, when you develop. So it's a big part of you. So it's really important, and it's a free gift that your kids can
exactly
can get. Yeah.
Exactly. Look, everything's in a context in that regard. I started school in the 1940s, and it was a difficult place to be different. Australia was a difficult place to be different, whether you were Asian or Mediterranean, unless you were white European. For anybody else, it was a difficult place to be different. And there was a lot of pressure to, well, particularly on young people, not to be different.
Why was that, do you think? Were they kind of...
It's racial.
Yeah, so it was racial. I mean, because I wasn't brought up, you know, at that time, so I don't know how that was, but I absolutely agree with you, being Swedish is probably easier in Australia than being Southern European.
Pakistani.
Exactly. And I remember actually it was quite interesting, if you don't mind me sharing, I was at the gym once and I was sitting there next to a few men on the spin bikes, and they were pointing out something about this man that was, I don't know, Italian or Greek, and they said something that wasn't so nice, and I picked them up straight, because I think they said wog, or, you know, that. Yeah. And I went, so what do you think I am? Oh, but you're not the same. I said, hang on there, but I am. Yeah. But you just look at me differently. So yeah. I put them on their spot there. So it's interesting you saying that it was a little bit more challenging at the time.
And all that's happened over time really is the targets have been moved. Each new wave comes. It's a complex situation, but it really, in some respects, it's fear of the other.
Yeah.
It's fear of the other. And when you're young, being accepted, and this is not just about race either. You can't be the kid who doesn't have the fashion backpack. You can't be the kid that doesn't have the designer sneakers. We all need to be part of, you know, not different. So, but the race thing, I've been very open all my adult life about the problems that this country hasn't come to grips with, and until it does, we've got serious problems that still need to be addressed, and we see it now with the embracing of the Uluru Statement from the Heart, things like that, where there is some recognition that there's been an overwhelming by white Europeans. It's not just the Aborigines, but it's anyway. These are important issues, and they come back to just who we are.
Yeah.
And I come back to my view of things, that we're all part of the whole. And whether you want to look at the Milky Way at night, I have a ritual before I go to bed every night. I go out and I look at the stars.
Yeah.
And I write to my grandchildren about some of the things that I see. I send them an SMS at 4:30 in the morning. Oh, my goodness, there are 6 planets. This was the other day.
In
the morning and I thought, there's Mercury, there's Venus, there's Jupiter, there's Mars, there's Saturn. And I send my kids anyway, when I was a kid, I'd go out and admire the night sky after dinner at night, and there wasn't the light pollution, but I still have that routine. Before we go to bed at night, I always go outside and have a look. And it's readjusting. We're part of that.
Yeah.
We're part of that before we're born, eons of time. We remain part of it when we die. So whether you believe that our soul goes to heaven, or whether we're cremated, or whether we're buried in the earth, the worms have a go at us, or we're we're deposited at sea, we're made up of matter that is eternal. Made up of atoms and molecules. So there is our endurance, and we're all, when you look out at the Milky Way, that's us.
How beautiful.
That is us. And when we die, all that changes is our consciousness of that. The matter that we're made up of is still the same carbon atoms, the same molecules of water or whatever. It helps remove our arrogance of being in control, that human arrogance. And the sky helps do that for me, keeps me balanced in that respect. I am not all powerful. We are not all powerful. But something happened to me a long time ago, and I actually happened to look into the eye of a whale.
Oh, wow.
Deep eye contact with a whale.
Yeah.
Very humbling. And the hairs are coming up on my arm now, just thinking about it. And there was this deep, endless wisdom behind that eye. And I couldn't interpret it. I just knew it was there.
Yeah.
And if I ever got the chance to look into the eye of a mother elephant, the same thing would be there, that deep, deep knowledge and wisdom. They can't articulate it. They can't pontificate the way I am now. But it's there.
Yeah.
It's extremely arrogant to say, we're above all that.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, absolutely.
In the eye of that whale, she knew where she had to go from Antarctica to wherever.
Yeah.
She knew the route within half a kilometre either side. She knew what she had to do when she got there. She knew it all. No mother, no university to teach her. I work in estuaries day in and day out, and there are little birds that fit in the palm of your hand. They come to us here from Siberia and Alaska, like that. They know the way. They come to that precise spot every year.
Yeah.
They know the way. They know where to stop.
Yeah.
They know the flyway. I'm mentioning this because it comes back to that sense of balance, and it's too easy for us to be arrogant.
Yeah. And you also said
who we are.
Yeah. So you also said one of the keys was to have a routine. And one of the keys is, understanding that we're all connected, you know? And as you say, that's such a beautiful thing, but I think we've lost a little bit of that, understanding that if we do damage to, something on Earth or animals or Mother Earth, well, it's going to have a greater impact on us all.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
Some of our chickens are coming home to roost. Look, I believe in science, and I believe with clear heads and good work, pardon me, we can do better. We can make a lot of things better. There's a lot we can't undo. But I'm a science optimist. We just need to be able to overpower with science and good intentions, selfishness, greed, avarice, all of those things. We need to be able to overpower that with good science coupled with good intention. Everybody has grandchildren, whether you're poor or whether you're living in a Vaucluse mansion, we've all got grandchildren. What you do now may or may not resonate on what your grandchildren inherit. And by that, I don't mean a wealthy estate. It's other things that are becoming more and more important. So,
absolutely. And I think too, you're talking about education, and that's obviously very important to learn, but that wisdom that comes from experience and wisdom that, you know, animals and other beings have that we can't underestimate. I mean, it's something that comes from, you know, a mix of learning and experiencing things, you know, learnings of life and learnings of material and study and all that, but most of all through our own, you know, experiences. And yeah, I feel that when, I mean, not necessarily, we can't look at it from an age point of view, because I meet a lot of older people that I feel are not as wise. And then you have younger people that have got like wisdom as anything, like really, like I find that really fascinating. Do you?
A lot of young people get it. They really do. And I've been involved with one of the community service organisations I belong to has a Youth of the Year competition, and it's about leadership development and what. The kids that come through there give me great optimism about the future, because those kids collectively, kids get it.
Yeah.
And I look around the table at a lot of the older people in the audience who will never get it, but these kids coming through do get it. So you're right.
Yeah.
However, it's up to us as we go through to nurture those values which take us to a better place. The fact that we're all basically the same, our needs are the same. We all have children that we love and want a good world for. We all have the potential to hit hard times. And we'll someday be hungry. We'll need a roof. So we have a responsibility to nurture those values in our children and grandchildren that recognise those things.
Mm.
So we're comfortable, but we're not an island. We're not removed from all of that.
Yeah.
So that's another form of education.
Yeah.
This nurturing of values.
Any other key points that you feel is really, really important for, you know, being as balanced as we can? I guess, as I always say, as we go through life, you know, we go through different stages, and some things in our life we focus on more at one point in our life, and then it changes as you get to a different point, and it's kind of navigating through that, isn't it? Navigating and recognize and accept at that point in time we're at. But yeah, I'd love to hear another key point to a balanced life from you, George.
I'm gonna throw a word in, Karen.
Yeah.
Intimacy.
Intimacy.
The value of a hug.
Yeah.
The value of knowing that somebody cares.
Yeah.
Intimacy takes very many forms, but touch, the nature of eye contact.
Yeah.
The things that we can talk about and share.
Yeah.
All of those can be involved with what I call intimacy.
Yeah.
Obviously, it involves sex. We're sexual beings, and that all comes under, I think we all have a need, and we all suffer if we're deprived of intimacy. It's taking a child to her bosom. It's if you're in tears, a caring hand on your shoulder or a hug.
Yeah.
Or being able to talk to you about things that are important to you with that. Meaningful eye contact. Says, you know, I care about this conversation. I care about you. That's all under this umbrella of intimacy. So I place intimacy in that, those handfuls. And as I say, that necessarily include sex. And while you can, do it.
That's fantastic. And I think that sometimes I just know some people that I know, they say, no, I'm perfectly happy, you know, by myself. And it's like they're pushing that part away, which I truly believe myself, just like you, George, that it is, we are human being, and that's one of the basic needs. You know, we do need that physical contact, you know. It's very, very important, isn't it?
Look, it reveals itself in pet ownership. You know, your dog, it's non-judgmental about us.
Yeah.
It wants a pat on the head. It will even give you something if you're not good to it. That's the sad thing about animals. You can abuse them and they'll stay with you. But we do draw some form of intimacy from pet ownership, our relationship with animals, because they're not judgmental and they'll give us that bit of warmth, that bit of comfort. Somebody by your side or somebody on your lap while you watch TV. So we can be alone, but while the cat's in your lap watching TV, we're not. So that all that falls under the umbrella of some level or other of intimacy. While some people maybe may cope or be happy being on their own or whatever, I don't think that's part of the human condition, personally. I think we need some level of intimacy in our lives.
Yeah. It may be because of past experiences they've had and they push it away. Who knows?
Yeah.
Who knows? But as human beings, I believe, just as you, it's important. And hopefully you're in a healthier, balanced relationship where it's working. Because that's important to acknowledge that you are in a happy relationship.
Yeah, look, all of that.
Yeah.
But if there is an intimacy, you're also putting up a barrier, however small or large. Without intimacy, you're putting up barriers to honest discussion.
Yeah.
Honest discussion, and I'm talking now between individuals, not honest discussion between one politician and another, or on, you know, I'm talking now about our relationships, but with intimacy, hopefully there's honesty in the things we can talk about.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Because through intimacy, you know each other.
Yeah.
There's understanding.
Yeah. And I got the sense that you got a beautiful lady in your life when I met you on the beach.
Yes, yeah.
Yeah, I just sensed that. And I even got you to give her a kiss, didn't I?
Well, and you recorded that. And I have shared that. I've shared that with my children and grandchildren.
Well, you did say, didn't you? I can never show my kids this. And I thought that was the most beautiful photo.
Yeah.
It was absolutely beautiful, I thought. It really showed the love in between you two.
We've shared a lot. We've been married now since we married in 1967.
Wow.
And so we've shared a lot. Ups, downs. Well, we've built a life and a family from two kids embarking on what at the time was a lot of fun and not a care in the world, with jobs, making a bit of money, nights out, restaurants, friends, parties, but you know, we've built a lot from that,
and
we now have a comfortable existence. We had a family birthday last night.
Yeah.
We were all together. There was warmth. There was happiness. And, Sue and I came home feeling comfortable.
Yeah.
Comfortable. But you know, one last thing, Karen.
Yeah.
I can't think of anything worse than being on your deathbed and having regrets. So if there's things that you can address between now and that moment that will remove some regrets, do it.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And it's a good question to ask ourselves. I often ask myself that, you know, like what do I want to kind of think and see my life having been when I'm taking my last breaths, you know, looking back and really being thinking that, you know, I had a really interesting life, you know, I really did what I loved doing and I gave and I was there for my kids, whatever those values are. And reflecting on that can be really powerful, can't it?
Yeah. I mean, obviously things happen in your life that you can't turn around. I can't make myself now a better high school student than I was, lazy, distracted. I can't change
that. No.
But if there are things unfinished, if there are things that you don't want to go regretting and you can do something about it now, do it. Because we all want that comfort. We want that comfort. So my mum went into care. She was in care for about 10 years and she lived just in care just down the road. Yeah. And I visited her every day. There are a number of things that have been a privilege, but one of them was to be with her at the end. For about 10 days, I sat beside her during that process and I shared her breath.
Wow.
In that little room. And I thought about my mum and her life, and she died with comfort. She knew that we were all right. We were all okay. And that's, you know, I looked at her and I thought, well, Mum, you've done a good job.
Yeah.
We're all okay.
Yeah.
We're all okay. Now, with her in the private space of her own head, she had things that I'm talking about, regrets or whatever. Nonetheless, she knew that we were all okay. And I think that's probably the biggest thing when we've got children and grandchildren.
Yeah.
They're all okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
So we look for that comfort.
Yeah. Can I ask you, how old was your mum when she passed? How old was she?
98.
That's a good life to have, isn't it? 98. So what are some of the things that you are looking forward to doing in your next 20, 30 years, George?
Look, for the time being, I believe I can do more of what I'm doing now. Maybe the pace changes.
Yeah.
I've got a knee that's on the way out, and an orthopedic surgeon is going to give me certain advice about that. But the fact that I keep myself fit and well means I've got an optimistic position about the outcome after the orthopedic's done his bit of carpentry. I want to remain connected. I belong to groups, and as long as I can, I want to maintain that. I want to do it with the partnership of Sue. She doesn't involve herself in my things, but she shares my at-home activities with those things.
Yeah.
She's got her own Sue things, and that's nice. Look, basically more of the same. I'm very happy with what I'm doing and the way that I'm aging.
Yeah.
So I can't make myself 18.
No.
If I can just maintain my discipline, go out every night and gaze at the stars.
Yeah. What a beautiful routine. I love that.
Gaze at the stars. I don't think my kids' grandchildren thank me like at 4:30 in the morning when their phones are going bing, bing, bing with SMSs coming in. But hey, that's me. I'm driven by passion.
Yeah.
That's me. So, yeah, as long as I can, I've got birds at the back. I grow my little plants. I love the bush. I go bush walking. But my focus comes back to the estuarine environment, the marine.
Yeah, so that's your passion. And what about the photography? You really are passionate about that too, aren't you?
Yeah. That records a lot of my work. When we were in South West Rocks, I'd been up, there's a small estuary there, and I've done a paper for the local council, a photographic interpretation of that. I'll explain what the processes are, but I do it by photographs with a narrative attached to the photograph. So I've just got that ready for printing now. And
Okay, fantastic. That's great. Isn't it interesting going back to serendipity a little bit, George? And I believe that, you know, you meet people for a certain reason, people come into your life, and you know, like meeting you just randomly at the beach like that and striking up conversations and feeling like there was some sort of deeper connection there. Isn't that interesting? And then I hear too, you used to row, you know, I used to row. We both got photography also. There's a lot of things we've got kind of in common too. But tell me a little bit about the rowing that you were doing.
We lived in a place called Rod Point, which is on Iron Cove in Sydney, and just across the bay was the Haberfield Rowing Club. and one of the neighbours said, "Come on, son, you're a little sparrow," and I was. "You'd make an ideal coxswain." So off I went as a boy, sitting up the back of the boat, calling out the strokes and the place and what have you to the crew. But of course, the time came when they said, "Hey, you're getting too lumpy for all this. Get on the end of an oar," and so that's what I did until shift work interfered with my capacity to train. So I did that for some time, and I never lost the interest in it. In fact, we had we scattered Mum's ashes down there where we all grew up, and she lived for all those years, and We had a family reunion on that day at the rowing club. And it's where I met Sue.
Oh, wow.
We met at a dance at the rowing club, and she was to be there on a blind date with a famous rower. Yeah, he was an Olympian. And for one reason or another, he didn't turn up. She did, and I was there with a group, and we connected that night. We danced, we went for coffee afterwards, and then it was a date, and the rest is history. So they were my rowing years, and I still row. I have a little boat on Port Hacking, and I still go out. Now it's the winter mornings, but I'd be out in the dark of a morning up until about 2 years ago. In the dark, in the morning, rowing on Port Hacking. I'd come back, come home, have breakfast, and then go for my swim. So yeah. I've maintained the love of that, and I've got a little motor launch.
Yeah,
it's a family resource, and we can sleep on and what have you. If somebody said to me tomorrow, "You've got to give up one of those two boats,"
yeah,
motor launch that you can sleep on, that's got hot and cold water, or your little rowing boat, which would you give up? You know the answer, Corinne. You know the answer.
I think you want the little rowing boat. Yeah. Did I tell you my story about the rowing?
Tell me.
That's how I came to Australia. Did you know that?
No. Well, I don't know very well. You know more.
No,
about
that, but that's what I'm saying. I didn't row to Australia, but I rowed for Sweden. 1990, I rowed for the World Rowing Championships in Tasmania.
Oh. My goodness.
Well, there you go. That's my story. Well, it was the love for rowing and also love that brought me to Australia, because my ex-husband, he was rowing for Australia. And that got me on a journey to moving to the other side of the world.
So were you in a crew?
Yeah, I was in a lightweight double scull.
Right.
I was a lot smaller than I am now. Well, you're still the same size, but I'm slightly bigger.
You know, we started on this with a thing called mindfulness.
Yeah.
And rowing brings to the essence mind, every stroke, every breath, the timing.
Yeah.
If there's anything that imbues mindfulness, it's especially when you're rowing with another person or a crew,
yeah,
it's that you have to be in that split second moment, nowhere yeah else. And you understand what I'm saying.
Absolutely. I mean, rowing to me has been more about being a mindfulness practice than the competition sides. I mean, it's all those training sessions in nature. Now I mean, such beautiful spots I've been. I traveled in spring down to Austria on the lakes where you got the mountains with the snow on there, you know, experiences where in the late autumn in Sweden when I rode and you can hear the water starting to freeze and you can hear a little bit of crackling. It's just, to me, now what I've done, I've gone from rowing, then I decided a few years ago I need that connection. So I actually learned how to surf ski, George. So I've got a surf ski and I love being out on the ocean, and that was an alternative for me. So yes. And what I wanted to say too, because you tapped into it a little bit before, for me, sport and being out in nature like that, it's actually, I call it, it's been a lifesaver for me when I've gone through really challenging periods, yes, like divorce and, you know, really, really challenging periods. If I didn't have my mindfulness or my sport, I don't honestly know how I would have gotten through those times. So that is a really, really important thing to me. And it sounds like that's helped you too.
Very much.
Mm.
Very much. And the pursuits have you in the elements, in the natural yeah elements. Look, I think there's a beautiful thing in rowing. And as I said, every breath,
yeah,
it's part of a rhythm.
Yeah.
The hitting of the blade in the water, it's all part of a rhythm. And you can't be anywhere else.
No.
The minute you're anywhere else, it all falls apart.
Exactly. And it's actually, people don't, I think, realise what a graceful sport rowing is. And particularly, I rowed a lot of single scull and double scull, but I trained in single scull. And there, it's like, it's all about timing, being graceful, knowing exactly when to add the pressure, how to keep the speed, to keep the boat moving quickly without disturbance. And it's graceful.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. It's beautiful. My biggest thrill came in an eight, in the
yeah area. Yeah.
And I was still small, so I was in the bow seat.
Yeah.
But just the collective power coming through coordination, and those eight breaths going in and going out, those eight bodies. To me, that was just.
Yeah, it's incredible. Yeah, it's incredible when you got that timing and you, it's just incredible.
Yeah. And unless everyone is in that moment, it all falls apart. Very quickly and very badly, as you know.
Exactly. Well, there's been a lot of really amazing key points to keep a balanced life, George, and having the perspective from someone that is just a little bit older than myself is is really valuable to me, because I do think that there's a lot of wisdom there. You know, a lot more reflection, and I think it's important for younger people to really listen and take it in, you know, because life goes really quick, doesn't it? Really quick, do you say?
Well, that rustling you can hear in the background of the pages of the calendar flicking over, boom, boom, boom. That's how it seems. It does go quickly, but it's still all about quality. It's the quality, and a lot of that's in our own hands. Just take the time and make sure that whatever we're doing, that there's quality. But there's got to be for me some wider thing.
So before we finish up, George, is there anything else that you find really, really important that you would love to share with the listeners and the people who are watching?
Only to say that we achieve the best things, by seeing the other as one of us. And I think if we do that, then a lot of the things that create unhappiness, create division, to see the other as one of us, I think that's critical to our joint existence here.
Mm.
I would add that we also see ourselves as part of the natural world and not something bigger, greater. We're just another thing. And I go back to looking in the eye of that whale, and that was so humbling, and I could no way do that and think that I'm better than you. I'm something greater. Just recognition of that we're part of something bigger, and that includes embracing the other.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that I see the light in you, that is it, the light in me as well.
Yes.
Yeah. So that's beautiful. I think that's really, really, really important point. You know, that was the most important point for me to remember that, you know. It's been a great pleasure having conversations. I could be talking with you for a long time, George. We'll have to continue having heartfelt conversations another time.
Yes, but I think that would be lovely, Karina.
Yeah, and we will definitely stay in touch.
Yes,
And would love to hear if the listeners or the watchers have got any questions or comments. Of course, this podcast will be on the Transform Your Wellness podcast. It will be on YouTube and on Facebook. So the information is there. You can contact us and perhaps ask George questions or myself questions, we can get back to you. But thank you so much, George. I really appreciate your time, and please send my love to Sue. I will talk to you soon again.
Okay, we'll be in touch. Thank you very, very much. It's been a pleasure.
Yeah, thank you so much. Bye, George. Bye.